Mr. Chadwick, Reel 8. We were talking about your time with 7 Platoon C Company of 16th Battalion, and we're looking at sort of patrolling techniques as used in Italy, although using some of your later experience to comment on what was going on. I think that's fair to say. We're talking about reconnaissance patrols. So when you went out, you mentioned the radios. Was this the eight? What set would you take with you? You'd have a...
An 88 set, then, please.
And that was portable?
Portable.
So you'd have a signaller with each group?
Well, yeah, but not a qualified signaller. An infantryman. This is just for internal communication. You're not on net with battalion headquarters. You only need a signaller for that. A regimental signaller. This would just be a soldier. I'll tell you my story later about that. A lad, he might be getting a morning's instruction on it, and that's sufficient for him.
Now, how did you went out, how did you get information without coming into contact with the enemy? I mean, what were the principles you'd use?
Oh, really? It was a farmhouse or something of that nature. Two government fellows walking around, talking, sentries, how many? And then making a good assessment, a truthful assessment you could, so that the company commander could build the bigger picture, saying, well, we're going to take it, we need a company, because there's obviously 20 or more men there, or whatever. So that was the idea, getting the information back. But people felt far safer going out on the reconnaissance patrol than they did on the fighting patrol. As I previously said, it was sticky. But the reconnaissance, with your deftness and your skill and ability, not to be observed yourself, but to observe the enemy and get the information back.
So if you saw a German patrol when you were on a reconnaissance?
Lie low. Hit the deck. Let him pass if necessary. And move the opposite direction, but don't contact him.
Now, when did the Germans ever use star shells or very, you know, things?
Well, we did and they did. Again, I'm sure you're asking my opinion. I would never dream of using one. Because I think it shows fear and your lust. If you get the 2-inch mortar that you fire an illuminating flare, which came down on the parachute, and it would light the area, you've lost everything. You can see him and he can see you. So what the use of it was, I failed to fear. And very rarely were you used by either side. Unless you're in a static position like the First World War, where they flung them up piecemeal, to see if anybody was crawling forward or whatever. But for patrol work and that, absolutely fair to use one.
One of the things that that people often discuss as to whether when things like that happen, or indeed when you suddenly catch sight of the enemy, is it better to drop to the ground or to stay still? In other words, stay stood up but stay but
or
freeze. So it's better to be low down and under.
Make yourself the least possible target. Flat on your cloak.
Didn't they feel that the movement would attract attention, whereas standing still wouldn't? I mean, I'm not saying this, I don't know.
Right. Well, let me put it this way to you. We're all human beings, and instinctively, if you're frightened of something, you're going to make yourself the least possible target, and you'll hit the floor. Now, you're not hitting like a ton of bricks, and as I said initially, you're lightly clad for that purpose. There's nothing jangling. You haven't got magazines and things belting around you, tin hats falling off and all this. Hit the deck. Well, you're not thinking gently, but hit the deck and just lie there.
Now, another thing I want, were you ever surprised by the Germans in the sense of, you know, we've talked about your patrols surprising a German patrol. But did they ever, by the nature of things, surprise?
My experience. It has happened. I know it has happened. And, you know, the thing that we all forget in war, they're just as frightened as you are. And they're looking for a way out of it. And there were times, I know, where the Germans spotted a patrol and they turned up and opted, although they had some reality in numbers. Because the self-preservation is there on both sides.
What do you think gave the British patrols the advantage? Because it seems if we ambushed them more than they ambushed us, then we must have had an advantage. Was it just that our patrols were smaller and harder to spot?
I think the main thing was, don't let anybody say the Germans aren't good soldiers. They are. But, they're answering, but with a capital B, they've got to be led. They're not soldiers with their own initiative. They're so drilled to accepting and working on orders that when they become on their own, they're in turmoil. And it's not things you mean, it's a fact of life. Now, the British, far from faultless, but if the patrol commander got knocked off, which he invariably did, one of them would take over immediately. But the Germans wouldn't, and we spoke to them about it. They'd be in turmoil. And the only way they'd go would be backwards.
Now, just to finish the patrol, the standing patrol, I mean, how would you prepare for that, and how many would there be on that? Or was that, again, the same size?
Well, it depends on the tactical dispositions. You'd say, similar if you called 1 and 6, 1 and 8. One of the things, by sending a few extra men, is you are company for one another, even though you're not talking. There's a bit of comfort in strength that you know there's so many of us. Now, their information is purely one thing only, an early alarm signal. If the troops are on the reverse side getting sleep, and they're all quite relaxed and everything, they're not going to be caught with their trousers down. That standing patrol will fire the alarm, and everybody then will instantly jump to it. I mean, when I say sleeping, we've got, still got the boots and everything on. It's just their eyes are closed and they're sleeping. There's only one aim for standing patrol: to give advanced information to the main body.
Well, they'd fire and retreat, I presume.
They'd fire, and the wireless one would be in contact with the company wireless and tell them enemy approaching, approximate strength, etc., etc., and off. Make their way back, and by then, the troops on the ground would be up into the slits, the trenches, whatever, sandbag pits, whatever they had, ready to engage the enemy.
Wasn't that quite a nerve-wracking task, standing patrol, then?
Really, yeah. Because you could be lulled into a false sense of security. And if you lie, again, the reason why you want 8 to 10 if possible, if you're looking into the dark at any length of time, you start seeing shadows. So you've got to relieve them. And then as though, you don't go to sleep, of course, just get down and get your eyes accustomed again. Close them and open, close them. And relax your eyes. Because if you keep peeling and you're tense, you're seeing all kinds of movement that's not there. And you're liable to give a false alarm and betray your own position.
Did you actually experience that? Was there a problem with men actually falling asleep on that duty?
Yeah. But that wasn't the thing you could charge a man for. They were tired. And they were tense. And the resistance was low, hence all these evacuations you were getting. And it was so hard to keep awake half the time. Being frightened helps you to keep awake, but you can only go so long. And once if you let yourself be lulled into a false sense of security, for instance, you say to yourself, thank God we're going to have a quiet night tonight. And I've done my stack, so I'm working all day. And the next thing you're awake, so somebody, if you do, that's acceptable, it's got to be. Because depending how long you've been in the line, the loss of sleep does catch up with you, ultimately. You know, it's hard to keep awake under very long nights. The days aren't bad, but the nights are long.
Now, how about the division of responsibility between the various ranks? Who was the most important to you? You're a second lieutenant, or your captain, or your senior NCOs, or your very junior NCOs?
Let's take commissioned officers first. The hardest rank for commissioned officers is platoon commander, because he takes the big patrols out. He does everything forward. His boss, the company commander, is back at company headquarters. So the three platoon commanders that were up at the three platoons, they take the rough edge. There's no doubt about that.
They'd go out with the patrols then?
Yes. But they can't take them all. They've got to designate. But any big ones, any tricky ones.
By big, you don't mean size, just mean important.
Dodgy ones. But they take them. And a very, very tough job. Plus, he's got to have the platoon tactics. Or if he decides to make an attack on something, he's got to do it all. The thing that people didn't bear in mind when they criticised a lot of our officers, they weren't much older than us, the two commanders. So they had a responsibility for 21 and 22-year-olds. I have a lot of admiration for them. Terrific amount. They took a lot, they had a lot on their plate. And when I look back at men like, not so much this, we had this, but Ronnie Sherlock and them, as company commanders, they were only 4 or 5 years older than me. And they were commanding a company, and all the relevant responsibilities go with it.
What about the senior NCOs then?
Well, the corporals and lance corporals. Take the brunt of that. Again, the main part of what we're talking about is purely patrol work, because the big actions are in it all together. The big ones are a piece of cake to me. You just follow the band, just go forward and see what comes of it. But the light actions, the fighting, as I say, the fighting patrol is the king of them all. Invariably, that was a corporal or a lance corporal who was in charge. A heck of a responsibility for a 19-year-old lance corporal. And you know, your men, like I am, 38-year-old, come from the artillery. Well, you were a little boy compared to them, but you were in charge. And I found the only way to gain their confidence was prove to them that you could do it and do it well.
Right, now we've looked at some general conditions in Italy. Now, the first time you went into the line, you weren't there long before you went to Greece. Are there any incidents from the fighting that you remember, or particular places, you know, as opposed to that general stuff we've just done, that you recall?
No, to be honest, not really.
How long would you be in the line at a time at that time?
2 to 3 weeks, they did. But, having said that, again, the tactical situation designated how long you were in. If the balloon blew up and you'd gone 3 weeks, you might have to do another two. They couldn't afford to let you out. So the tactical ploy at the time control when you went for a rest, or if you went for a rest or you didn't. But after 2 or 3 weeks, they get you out as soon as possible for the breather.
And what would you do on the breather?
Nothing. The first morning, you lie in bed till about 9, well, I said 8, wherever you slept. You got up, you went down for breakfast, 9 to 10, the first morning. Then you started getting your clothes exchanged, getting fumigated, baths, showers, medicals, FFIs.
FFI?
Fit and free from infection. Pre-fighters, should we used to call it. Inspected by the vet, as I said, for what they call mobile dandruff, all this business. And get up into the village and get drunk. Not roughly, or in my case, I was no saint. I went at night to try and get a game of sport, and you weren't fit as such, physically. You were tired, you were run down. But a game of football, you were all the same condition. A game of basketball, in the sunbathing, the weather was nice. Or whatever facility were available, whether you could have a swim or what. But generally, relax. And you know, going back into the line, just as a point of interest, not once, quite often. Say you were then busing at 4 o'clock that afternoon to start moving up the MSR. You get a fella walk up, and you know the regimental policeman, the avant-garde, he'd go up and he'd belt one of them straight on the chin, flattening. Well, the object of the exercise was to go in the nick, because he was better dead, of course. But they got wise to that, so what they used to do was bundle him on the truck and get him up there, and then when he came out, the first day he was on rest, crying, and then bang him in the nick for the period that you were out. All these little things happened with everybody. I'm not talking about the Germans, everybody.
All units.
Any excuse to get out of Florida. So, again, genuinely frightened, had enough, were weary, and should have been relieved. And to try anything to get out of going back, he's going to take much more.
You mentioned Casey showed it a bit. Did he show it before you went to Greece, or was that later he showed it?
He showed it there, and then he blew up in Greece.
What did he do in that you noticed in Italy, or were you just told about it?
Well, more or less, you never saw him. You see, seventh platoon could be in Liscard, eighth platoon could be at bottom of Mill Lane here, ninth platoon could be at bottom of Mill Lane this way. Yeah, but he saw one another. And as far as I couldn't command it, it was fully involved, company HQ, information, administration.
But there were rumours about him, weren't there?
Oh, yeah, hitting the bottle and one thing and another. I'll tell you about his farewell speech later.
Okay, but at that stage it was just rumours.
Just more or less being passed down. But there were so many of them. The sergeants were the same. If they could get hold of anything, local plump. Anything would do. Because there's no jamming that you get my age. There's some brilliant batches. Never went off the bridge.
What about Spicker and Smudger Smith? How are they?
Smudger was I don't think Smudger drank. I don't think he drank at all. It's a bit of a Bible somebody like, isn't it? And Spicker was a perfect gentleman. Well, I remember we're talking 50 years ago. He was a tall, very good looking lad. The first time we shouted fixed bayonets, well, you know, you've got private soldiers shouting, go on, get dotted or words. And it was alien to him. Yeah, but he soon fell into line, and of course, you get talking to the other officers, the older officers, who knew the lads better and the way they function. I mean, he certainly took over well. There was one little incident where he said it happened there.
In Italy, yeah.
At that stage of the war, people of a certain age who were in the grave abroad a certain length of time and had no family were granted a dispensation for early leave and sent home to see if they could start a family. I get this bloke's name, I think it was Carl Smith. But this batman was about 6'4", a chap your height, but massive. And he said, well, I'm going. He said, my wife can't have children. So before he went, the platoon he was in, I think it was Mr. Sandler, he had very, very bad eyes. And they were looking towards this object that they were going to attack. And he gave his old group off. And then he said, to go to the start line, I'll fire a bearing pistol. Now, this is in bad light. Wilkie, big Wilkie. Wilkie is stood with his legs astriding. Stanford, with having very bad eyesight, picked the bearing pistol up, he's on one knee, and fired it between his legs. Well, a scream. A little. That to be hit with a bearing pistol, so it goes home, kill him. The attack went in, etc., etc. And the moral of the story was Wilkie went home, and 9 months later his wife had twins. So you could work that one. So, when you're talking about birth control, but apparently that happened, well, it did happen. And he came back and he later said, my wife's like pregnancy. So they always said, if anybody's got any troubles, just let them fire a berry, but you know, berry pistol with the pyrotechnics, you know, green over red and red over green, fire it between his legs. But that did happen at that school.
Do you remember any of these little attacks, you know, that you were talking about? Or you don't remember them as a...
Not so.
Were you aware of, I mean, you've mentioned something to do with this, of the concept of shell hole droppers? It's a First World War expression. But basically, if you're leading or you're going forward and there are less people behind you than you thought because they've found various reasons for stopping, helping the wounded, tripping over, that sort of thing.
Barely don't.
Were you aware of that in the unit? Cause the
you're soon aware of that. I remember a little incident that happened with me where we were in the backyard of the house. 1 o'clock in the morning, I think it was. I think there was four of us. There was four of us.
Is it on a patrol?
No, we were just guarding. There was movement in front. And the next thing, I was on my own. They'd gone. They'd run round the other side of the house. I don't know what now they were doing. Well, we got sorted out there. You know, I said, well, you're right, Sparks.
What happened? Did the movement come to nothing?
There was movement in front. But that was resolved, we think, next morning. Some villages had got lost. Were moving about in front. They shouldn't have been, but they were. But I don't think it was an enemy. And what they said, which I accepted, we'd been here longer than you. And we are going a bit puddled. We've had enough. End of story. Understand.
Did you understand it then, or did you look down on them a bit?
I was terribly disappointed. But with hindsight later, I found it.
When did you start to get more understanding of that, would you say? I mean, was it within a month?
I was in a thinking person. I think right from the start. I was weighing everything. I was dying to see what went on and watch reactions. And I think it held me in good stead later.
So it didn't take long before you got to understand that sort of behaviour?
Not long at all.
Do you think that they...
You learned quickly, I think.
Do you think the 16th were any worse than any other unit that had been through the same sort of thing?
I think they were all apart. These things, if people are truthful, would say a lot more than admitted, but it did happen, and it must happen.
Was there a balance? I mean, so would a new battalion have performed better? Battalion that hadn't been through so much action?
Initially, yes. Because the excitement going in for most of, because we're talking predominantly young men. When they first went in, but after a period of time, say a comparable period of time that the 16th were talking about, they would do Everybody could go into the museum. Some were too much.
Because one thing is that sometimes they use battalions again and again, because although they're full of shell hole droppers and the rest of it, they're more experienced and they're actually better at fighting than an inexperienced battalion that might be actually braver, but they're not as good. Is that not the case?
I think one balances the other, to be honest, because there is a lot of tricks you learn. For instance, you know, everybody was looking for loot, watches, binoculars, souvenirs. But when you turn the body over and you get blown up, you learn not to touch it. You learn if you go to a farmhouse, you don't use the toilet, because if you pull the chain, you most likely blow the string. All that kind of business. As I say, the hardest part of any campaign, Peter, is the start. Because everybody coming up after you learns from their mistakes. But I still say that all battalions, without any element of doubt in my mind, absolutely, 101% certain, were all on a par. Men had had enough. It gets to them.
Were you aware of the other battalions in the brigade? I mean, were you aware of 139 Brigade?
Oh, yes. Oh, aye. You could see them operating from a distance. At night, they say, oh, there's the Foresters, there's the Lincolns, there's the Leicesters, there's the Beds and Herds. And word filters through how they're doing, you know.
Did you think well of them? For the second, fifth, for instance, the Sherwoods.
Well, anybody who's in your brigade are great. The Foresters had a rough night last night, or the Durham got a hell of a time, and so on. When you get out the line for a proper brig, the brigades together while you intermingle then, you know, and, but then again, they've as many joys in them as we had. So you're an international brigade, really, as far as counties are concerned.
Just one more. When you were out, did you have any concert parties in Italy? Were you aware of any?
They had them, but I never saw one. They had the Enza concert parties.
Or even local ones, you know, provided by the brigade or battalion.
We used to get the AKC, the Army Cinema, come up and show you a picture. You know, in a field style thing. But more of that when the war ended, really. Then you got quite an amount of that.
Anything else then before, because the battalion then went to Greece, you were flown to Greece.
Yeah,
anything else you want to say about that period of Italy before you went?
No.
So how did you first find you were going to Greece?
You just said, pack your kit, we're moving. Your practice kit, we moved. All in the dark. Everybody delighted, they were pulling out for a rest, going on a bit of a holiday. They were being flown home to go to D-Day, all rumours. Went down to Rome, the battalion did, got in aeroplanes, and we landed up at Kalamaki.